Bonds Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Whether you're new to the racing game or just looking to enhance your operation, Hermitage Farm and Goshen can help you. We are conveniently located between Churchill Downs and Keeneland Racecourse and near world-renowned equine hospitals. With spacious paddocks, expert staff, and qualified veterinarians, we offer full-service boarding, breeding, and sales preparation, as well as post-operative care and layup services. Visit us in person or online at hermitagefarm.com.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Scholarships are available. Visit rtip.arizona.edu.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Talk to Tom Albertrani in a little bit, who has retired. I've been looking forward to that visit with Tom and Seth Merrill as well, of course, in hour three. And Rachel McLaughlin, the first visit with Rachel for the 24 season at Horseshoe Indianapolis. And right now we're going to go north and west of Indy. To Minnesota and get an update from Joe Scordo on the status of things that just seem, Joe, to be honest, they seem to be nasty and acrimonious. I cannot even keep track of the HHR portion of this, and now I see that Taro Ito from Running Aces, he's had enough of being, you know, threatened and pushed around. Good morning.
Good morning from the Green North, Steve. Nice to be back with you again. Yeah, what's the saying? May we live in interesting times? Well, we're certainly doing that up here in the legislature in Minnesota regarding all the things that you pointed out. Just to give your listeners a quick update, then I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. The current status of the what we've deemed the revenge bill that would outlaw HHR directly, along with taking away powers from the Minnesota Racing Commission. And there were also lines in that legislation that would eliminate pick-end betting and also stadium-style blackjack play. Here in Minnesota continues to move forward. There have been amendments that we were able to get pulled out of the bill regarding the pick-end wagering on our horse racing product, as well as there will be an amendment introduced in a House committee meeting tomorrow that I assume will pass that will take out the stadium gaming restriction on the bill. But that still means that we will have an outlaw of HHR in Minnesota, along with the restricting of the powers of the Minnesota Racing Commission, more than likely moving forward both on the House floor and the Senate floor. So seeing that all happening, and I don't know if it was a direct result or if this has been something that Running Aces and their CEO, Taro Ito, have been planning for a while, but yesterday they filed a RICO lawsuit against the tribal leaders of three tribes here in Minnesota. And I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't read the full complaint, but basically what it points out is they have been unlawfully providing card games like three-card poker, pai gao, baccarat, those types of games, illegal at the casinos for years. And under their compacts, they're allowed to have slot machines as well as blackjack. These other games have been played there, like I had said, for a number of years. And according to Minnesota state law, the only place where it's illegal to play card games is at a licensed racetrack. So not only is Mr. Ito and Running Aces stating that these games were played unlawfully, but that the tribes owe millions of dollars to the purse funds of both Canterbury and Running Aces, since in law, we are to receive anywhere from 10 to 14% of those revenues.
How significant? I saw Rochelle Olson's piece in the Star Trib. This is a serious accusation, and it's obviously a leverage that that Ito is hoping to use, to get broader awareness of this fight. And I thought his quote about operating without fear of being eliminated, I applaud him. I mean, did he have, do you know if he had conversations with the Sampsons about, you know, about this? And is that, you know, am I right in assuming that he wants to utilize this as a way to, to level the playing field in what is obviously a fight for survival?
It's a good question. Number one, I'm not aware of any conversations between Running Aces and Canterbury Park. I do know from the horseman's perspective, we were not informed, nor are we part of the suit. I do find it interesting that Canterbury is not part of the suit, nor is Mystic Lake, the Midwakanton tribe, of which Canterbury had that long-term marketing agreement a few years back that ended. I don't think it's a leverage move. I really don't, Steve. I see this as something that they've probably spent a lot of time and money investigating and looking at the amount of money that should have come into the horse racing industry during that time from these tribes that should have been pointed towards purses and our racetracks. So if indeed, and I don't think they'd invest this kind of money if they didn't think they had a case, and it is a federal lawsuit, that there's something there to the financial end of it, of supporting our industry through purses. That being said, we all have to be a little honest with ourselves, and through the deposition process, this may force the tribes to open their books. And opening their books as far as the amount of money that they're making in this state and not providing tax revenue or going after charitable gaming to monopolize pull tabs here in the state, to go after the racing industry, to monopolize sports betting. All of a sudden, the story may change a little bit in the public eye. So it is going to be interesting, and it is going to be chaotic from now till the end of the legislative session. And needless to say, no one's rolling out red carpets down in St. Paul for the racing industry today.
Well, at the same time, and again, from using Rochelle Olson's piece as the template for the part of the conversation, a lot of this also revolves around the sports, the hope for sports betting, which will not come through the legislature successfully without Republican support. And the Republican interests basically align with the tracks, while the Democratic interests are aligned with the tribes. So there's got to be a there's going to have to be a summit of some kind here, where all parties, you know, I mean, the revenues, the tax revenues from the sports betting are, I imagine, like in every other state, too big of a, you know, of an incentive and a lure to bypass. So I imagine there's got to be a you know, a path forward to satisfy everybody's needs and interests.
Well, we would hope so, Steve. I apologize for the sigh, but the fact of the matter is, we've spent 2 years working from a collaborative position. We have met with legislators, we've met with the governor's office, we've met with the tribes. We've said, listen, we want to be collaborative. We want to establish a win-win. We want to promote sports betting when it comes to the state to make it successful. Just try to be fair with us on this. And we're not looking for handouts. We feel we deserve a license like anybody else. We want to compete. But if that is completely off the table, then we have asked the tribes in the legislature, well, come to us. And they've basically said, here's $600,000 to split up between three breeds and two racetracks. Now go away. And at that point, we just said, okay, we've got to start thinking about other opportunities to keep our sport moving forward. And it's a, you know, the industry is thriving with support from these modern gaming opportunities. And we just want to do that on a national basis. And obviously we understand the tribes don't want competition, but there's enough. There's enough here, and our door is open. We want to continue to meet with legislators in the governor's office to see if there's a path. You know, Randy Sampson has always been of that mindset and is always willing to talk and negotiate, but it just hasn't gone that way. And I recognize and understand why Running Aces and Mr. Ito have taken this approach. And though we're not part of the bill, it certainly does get everyone's attention. And if he happens to win this case, and I sense there's an opportunity there for that to happen, then at that point, there will be a lot of purse money coming into racing here in Minnesota in the coming years.
I mean, given what happened, you mentioned the Mystic Lake, the 10-year deal that Canterbury enjoyed with Mystic Lake, which provided a lot of stability. And during that time, whether it was the Minnesota engagement project for ownership, the work that went into Canterbury cultivating an average of a 7,500 head, daily gate. There were so many positives, and there was a lot of momentum, and Canterbury has always displayed a willingness to try things. Under the various the pushing and pulling that's going on here, what is this season essentially? What is the immediate circumstance look like for 24?
Well, I think for 24, it's going to be one of those years that we're going to try to keep purse levels. I believe they'll be just at that $10 million mark, and with fewer days, the goal has always been that $200,000 daily amount. From what I hear from Canterbury, the stall applications were still good. They're not like they were 2 years ago. But with a season that extends over additional days, even though fewer dates, the horse population still should be there to conduct a decent meet, Steve. We're not going to say it's what it was 2 years ago, with record handles and record simulcasts and record attendance and new ownership. I mean, like you had stated, we were hitting on all cylinders a couple years ago. But, you know, when you look at the Midwest and you've got Canterbury and Prairie Meadows and Hawthorne all running at the same time and with the lack of horse population nationwide, it's going to be a struggle. But, you know, Canterbury always finds a way and they do some innovative things and they've put an incentive program together for trainers this year. And I'm sure their wagering menu will offer a few tasty nuggets. But our future depends on what happens between the tribes and racing and the legislature. And there still is an opportunity for something to come out of this that would be very positive for racing. And if it doesn't, Steve, then it's just not going to happen. And unfortunately, Canterbury Park may go the way of Hollywood Park and Golden Gate and all the other racetracks, Arlington Park, you know, my hometown favorite. And it's sad because we're a regulated industry and we're at the behest of government. And when a government gets behind the racing industry, they get paid dividends. Everybody wins. When they are against the racing industry, which it appears to be the situation here in Minnesota, it's a real struggle.
Well, and that's actually well stated because, you know, with the vicissitudes, you know, from state governments, I mean, we've seen just in the last last couple of years. I mean, in the last 2 weeks, we saw you know, we see the positive in Maryland, and you know a path forward that you know is being hailed and well received. New York, you know, the pendulum swung from one extreme to the other. I mean, we've now got a governor and a relationship in Albany with, you know, with the state legislature that has never been better. You know, the results are new facilities and you know, when there's that atmosphere that's cultivated, you know, mayors show up in states and you know, the strength of the regional programs and you know, the incentives that come with that. And it just got to be just really frustrating. I mean, because people make long-term decisions about, you know, about their mayors and about, you know, their own programs. I will come back to what I brought up last week and the death of Bob Lothenbach. And because I can't believe that this situation would be festering, you know, in the way that it is, if Bob Lothenbach and his influence were available.
Right. And once again, it's the positive part is whether it be a Bob Lothenbach or somebody that lives in Shakopee, Minnesota, getting involved, the social media discussions, which you're doing to help our cause and spreading the word, the national groups that have reached out to us. This is something that I'm very pleased with, I guess, and appreciative of the fact that, you know what, when racing's against the wall, people do stand up. And I believe the legislators are hearing from constituents. The press is finally getting informed of what's really happening. And the more we get the word out, remember Canterbury Park and the Thoroughbred Horsemen have not been able to lobby and be down in St. Paul for a 10-year period of time under the Mystic Lake Agreement. So we missed all that opportunity to educate and let people know how important this sport is and how we need to compete on a national level. And I think we're in a short period of time. I think the horse people have done extremely well as Canterbury, in getting the word out. And maybe that's helped in preventing this revenge bill from being as catastrophic as it originally was. But now we need a path forward. And if they're going to outlaw HHR, what does that mean? And they're going to keep us out of the sports betting bill. What does that mean? And if it ends up being a path through the courts, probably something nobody wanted. But it seems like the only path that was apparent to running aces. And it's interesting that they took that path, and that could prove to be a positive for the industry as well.
Well, we'll continue to watch and with interest, obviously, and with concern for the future, because Canterbury's been, just a really positive out there for the game. I mean, the Samsons have tried to set an example, and you know, with aggressive pricing, the takeout experiment from a few years ago, the low 10% take that's been offered the last couple of seasons on multis, and they've tried so hard, and that's one of the reasons I really feel compelled, Joe, to track this and make people aware of what's going on. I mean, on that topic, say it again. I mean, is there anybody outside the state, or, maybe two questions. What should people inside the state do in terms of contacting their representatives? And is there anything a wider audience can do that would be welcome?
Well, Steve, thanks for offering, and what you're doing is helpful. And to your listeners within the state of Minnesota, it is contact your representatives and your senators and the governor's office, and let them know. What a lot of those folks don't understand is horse racing touches every corner of the state. It's not just Shakopee and Columbus, Minnesota, where the racetracks reside, whether it's breeding farms or one thing, we've received a lot of support from off-track thoroughbred owners. There's 29,000 retired thoroughbreds in this state sitting in barns that people are riding and competing with, and they love the horse, and so they've been supportive. So for anybody that's listening, certainly let their representatives and senators and the governor know. For people outside the state, just share the information. Let people know what's happening. And anybody that can offer to support or provide any guidance, we certainly are listening. I know other states have gone through some of this before, and we are learning as we're going, and we certainly appreciate the input from those individuals as well.
Joe Scorto, the interests of stakeholders and everybody that enjoys the game in Minnesota and the standardbred side. And we certainly hail Taro Ito and the Running Aces team for, taking up the cause aggressively on their end as well. That can only help. So, Joe, I'm sorry everybody's got to deal with this and sweat this out. But, when money's involved, the hands are out in every direction. And the one thing I'll repeat, it sure seems to me that you got legislators that are completely in the pocket of the tribes. I mean, doing all of their bidding. And it's one thing to advocate for any cause. I mean, we've got our own advocates. But it's another, to then vindictively, try to injure in this case, innocent parties in terms of racing interests.
Correct. And you know what? I think what the legislature is finding out is horse people don't have soft hands, Steve. And the fact of the matter is horse players also know how to take a loss and keep going. And that's what's happening here. So I applaud the people that are fighting this fight. I have to be optimistic that we will break through, but it won't come without some bumps. And to the people that are out there, when Canterbury opens next month, we'd appreciate your support through the ADWs as well, because that also demonstrates that we are a viable industry here in Minnesota.
Joe Scorto and the horsemen in Minnesota, keep me advised. Anything I can pass along, Joe, and continued good luck.
So appreciated, Steve. Thank you for your time.
Not at all. Joe Scorto and Joey Horseshoe, if you aren't following Joe yet. And there's also Midwest Paddock Report. The two of them, you know, have their fingers on the pulse of this situation. It is, you know, it's one thing. You know, you're looking, okay, you're looking out for your, you know, the you know, whoever essentially is donating to your, you know, to your election and re-elections. But, you know, the way in which, the way in which they've, as Joe characterized it, the revenge bill, you know, because the Minnesota Racing Commission gave approval for HHR. Okay, you want to go into your state legislature and say, you know, this is not. You know, it's one thing that you want to say, okay, we have this agreement with the tribes, then they've got exclusive, you know, rights to electronic gaming, if you want to call. You know, this gets into the definition, I suppose, of HHR. Is something that they went through, obviously, in Kentucky. If you want to oppose it like that and say, listen, we've got a deal, and these are, you know, these are fancy, HHR is a fancy name for slot machines. And, you know, then you could have a legal battle about, you know, the algorithm of HHR, you know, previously run horse races, and that, you know, that, based on those results, and that's the, you know, that's the trick that's involved in HHR. But what this bill does, I mean, in terms of vindictively, you know, seeking to injure racing interests, I mean, it's completely unnecessary. And all you have to do really is look, you know, there's any number of states where, you know, there's tribal gaming coexisting with, you know, with the racetrack. I guess Florida probably the best example, right? So and, you know, then fold in, I guess, you know, I guess you fold in the sports betting portion of this, and maybe they want all that for themselves, you know, but some of that, I suppose, depends on, you know, what else was, you know, what else is codified, you know, in terms of the way this is, you know, this is all, you know, it's all been addressed in what, the last 50 years, essentially. Some of this is fairly new. Seth is ready for us. So let me go get Seth Merrow, because Seth probably is as good a foil for this discussion as anybody over the years. Seth and I very frequently, you know, talked about what went on in Albany. And we, Seth, we don't really have to do that anymore, because now, you know, now Albany is a friend, and the governor, where the governor's mansion is inhabited by, you know, not just somebody that likes racing, but somebody who is a big advocate for racing and loves it. She wants to be a part of it. Good morning.
Good morning. And I said before, the whole franchise and the discussions in Albany a few years back completely changed the way I look at news in general, because you know, horse racing is a topic that I and you and I and many of the people listening know well. And so to hear the discussions that would happen down in Albany from the legislators asking questions, you were left thinking, they don't know anything about this. But you weren't really getting that through the news coverage. It was just a back and forth between the legislators and the folks in the industry. And I, at the time, I thought, well, there's a lot of topics that go on here, you know, in Albany and Washington, I also don't know anything about. And it became clear that the reporters don't know much about it either. So their coverage was lacking. And I'm wondering how often that happens in other topics. And I'm thinking it probably happens quite a bit.
Well, you and I stress this, and you know, people for years, when I would rail on the negative coverage that was emanating from the Times Union, from the Saratogian, you know, then downstate, particularly the Post was, had, you know, the Post was eager to write stupid things, you know, the characterization that went on for years that is now, thank God, at least has stopped, you know, the bailout. There was never a bailout. There was never a bailout of NYRA. There was a loan that was being repaid. But you know, the newspapers character, oh, we're bailing out the no, you didn't. So the lies and the distortions, you know, in an attempt by, you know, whatever parties were motivated. I mean, and it particularly was galling from upstate. You know, I understand, you know, the New York Post, you know, was just desperate to grist up any crap. But for the Saratogian and the Times Union, who received God knows how much advertising revenue from the economic engine of the racetrack. I mean, for them to take those positions and to distort reality was really egregious.
Yeah, it's, like I said, it was frustrating at the time to know better and to read articles and see news reports on television and just feel like, wow, these people are completely uninformed, and they are presenting something to a public that is also mostly uninformed. So the uninformed public is now thinking, well, this is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And to sit there and know better, it just was completely frustrating.
No, grotesque. And then, of course, you know, we've had, as I just discussed with Joe Scordo, you've got an ugly situation in the St. Paul in the Minnesota legislature. And, you know, here we are on the heels of, you know, the Maryland miracle that is going to, you know, reimagine and rebuild Old Hilltop. And we're in the process. I thought we were going to get Pat McKenna in, but Pat is really tied up, as is Andrew Offerman. We're going to probably get them next week to catch up. You know, they laid out the Belmont Festival purses day before yesterday. I wanted to go through that, but you know, we've got this entirely, you know, these other really positive, healthy examples of cooperative state governments. Appreciating, you know, the impact of racing. So it's a fascinating dynamic, and you know, there's plenty of things the game has done wrong, Seth. One thing was certainly, you know, not paying close enough attention to those relationships that, you know, that the powerful, influential people involved in racing had in the corridors of state governments. I mean, we were the essentially, you know, a tremendous tax engine, and we still are. But you know, the lottery came along, and now sports betting has come along, and you know, it's one of the things that NYRA deserves a tremendous amount of credit for. You know, in the last. You mentioned the franchise debate and the renewal. You know, NYRA really took to heart the importance of, you know, essentially lobbying Albany, and they turned things around. you can't argue nobody can argue, and you know, you've got Jeff Canizzo working full time on that topic for racing interests in New York. So this is, I know it's inside baseball to a degree, but it's worth talking about.
It's definitely worth talking about, and worth talking about for folks in the industry too, because you know, you kind of alluded to it. We talked about it a few weeks ago. Horse racing has been around a long time. These other forms of wagering, gambling, have come in, and they become more prominent in legislatures around the country, and they've addressed them and allowed them things, whereas racing has been around long enough that I think it was just easy for the folks in the state capitals to kind of ignore things. And we talked about it a couple of weeks ago with the anachronism that is Easter, no racing Easter in New York, which, again, I will continue to say, I don't mind a day off or a day to recognize the holiday, but they're not allowed to take wagering in New York, not only on New York racing, but anywhere else. But you can go to a casino and bet all day on Easter, and you can go buy a lottery ticket at a convenience store. And I think that anachronism that is shown there is reflected around the country, and that horse racing gets a little bit ignored because they've been around a long time, and these other forms of gambling are kind of the new shiny penny, and they're getting more attention. And I think the racing industry kind of has to, as you say, realize that and work the halls of the various legislatures themselves.
Meanwhile, I'm home now for for a week and change, and I got to tell you, the excitement, Seth, that I'm sensing from people about Belmont at Saratoga is just crazy. Everybody, you know, and granted, I was gone for over a month, and so I didn't see a lot of people in various places and on occasions, but so that's natural to bring it up. But boy, people are ready. This is going to be, and I got to tell you, I'm going away for 4 weeks starting Friday, and it's going to be fun to you know, come home from Baltimore and you know, not have to expect 2 weeks later to go down to, you know, down to Long Island, although I'd love going down. But it'll be nice to, you know, to have the home game, as Jay Pribman calls it.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I heard you out in California said your favorite track, Santa Anita. Come on.
That's been my answer for a long time. It is. I
love to. That's one track I haven't visited. I'd love to get out there in Del Mar. I'd love to get out to both of them because, yeah, Santa Anita looks gorgeous, no question about it. But yeah, the excitement level here, really going back to December when things started to kind of firm up that Belmont was going to be here. And, you know, people recognize me from the morning television in the supermarket or whatnot. So people walk up and there's just been thumbs up. Really, as I say, for going back to the end of the year. And it's just as we're getting closer and more information is coming out, it's ramped up. And it is going to be huge. There's no question about it.
Now, we'll get the details of the program and the condition book. Won't be long, actually, until it comes out. And I did notice Andy, who we didn't get a chance to talk to yesterday, but Andy noted this morning, I thought we weren't getting turf back until next week, but I'm thinking that there was a turf race or two offered on an overnight, because Andy said that they're, as an extra maybe, because they're taking entries. Here, let me go to the... There wasn't an extra, so it must have been in the book for Saturday.
Well, I know here the weather the past couple of days has been gorgeous, and you drive around, and there's plenty of green grass on people's lawns, and so I'm assuming downstate probably very much the same. I mean, you look at the video, and you can see that there were some pictures on social media as well. Very nice green turf course there. So, and I'm sure they are anticipating that should the weather hold up nicely, they have the opportunity to get back on because of that. And turf racing being as popular as it is, you want to get on sooner rather than later. I think I read Laurel is kicking back into the turf season this week as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, and here's there's a open fillies and mares long on the turf for Saturday, as it happens, and same for the boys for Sunday. There's also a stake for the mares on Sunday, long on the grass, and yeah, there's your first three. That looks like your first three, and then next weekend, we're hoping to run Shazando next weekend on the grass. He's ready to roll. And there it is, the 26th. I thought next Friday was going to be the first turf, but no, it looks like Saturday. Assuming we stay dry, a very welcome addition to the betting lineup will be some turf races.
Yeah, the sooner the better. You get some nice full fields in there and kick into the spring season. I think everybody's ready for it.
All right, so that'll be later. That'll be later today. What are you doing? Some Keeneland?
Yeah, I have a little Keeneland in Tampa today.
You're hanging in. You're hanging in. You're like a cat. You're like the cat on the poster. Hanging on.
Tampa's really one of the better tracks though, on a Wednesday.
All right,
this time of year. So
I will absolutely yield to your fine decision making.
I mean, when it gets into the weekend, I'm more Keeneland and Aqueduct, and I'll throw some Oaklawn in as well, but on a Wednesday. But, yeah, you want some Keeneland thoughts?
Yeah, let me pull, because I've got it as well. And I mentioned, I did mention the 2-year-old race to start the morning, actually. That's the first thing I've been looking at are the baby races.
Of course, you always have to take a look at Wesley Ward in there. But here, the opener, I went with Joe Kristofek. His Brilliant Racing has She Talks to Angels for Norm Cassie. I thought the debut effort was pretty good. Now they move on an optional claimer into a maiden special, but it's one of those restricted maiden specials based on the auction price and comes in with a little bullet workout. So I thought that horse was kind of logical. Razzle Red looks pretty good for Riley Mott. If you're looking for a little bit of a price at 4-1 on the morning line, I love Cozy End Runners to win early. So I debated putting Vino Veloce on top, but put it down in the third spot. The opener, I was 3-1, 3-5, 1-6.
I didn't really look at this, but of the ones that have run, you know, any amount, that Sanctify at 8-1 for Catman. That's kind of the 6 actually catches my eye a little bit. All right. What else?
The 5th race, I'm going to box mine up in an exact if the prices hold. The 5th race is a conditional claimer if they're going about 7. I'm 6, 7, 8, and 2. I thought at 8-1, Baytown Lovely was interesting. The Turfway runners are doing okay. This one comes off a little bit of a dud, but comes back and drops, and I think gets maybe back to the more proper level where the horse ran well 2 starts back. So I thought at 8-1, that one's playable. And Crystal Symphony at 10-1 on the morning line, also coming in from Turfway. Been away a little bit, but lately comes back at the reduced rate. The maiden breaker for 50, I thought was a pretty good looking race. If we could get back to that, I could see that horse being playable at price. Blenheim Baby, also lightly raced. Freddie Keneally looks pretty good. And then Out of Nothing at All, down at the bottom of my mix with Jose Ortiz, who's getting his Kentucky sojourn off to a pretty good start so far at Keeneland. But I'm going to box them up if the top two are offering prices like they are in the morning line, 6, 7, 8, and 2 on the 5th.
I thought you mentioned Blenheim Baby. I think you can put a line through the Turfway experiment, trying the synthetic, and drops back down below even the level of the maiden 50 try. Actually broke the maiden with a trip to Mahoning Valley. 7-2. There's not much value, but I that race two back beats most of these.
Yeah, I agree. He's a player. I thought the other two had a little bit of interest, though, because of the prices.
Fair enough. I can't argue.
Let me see here. The other sibling to Gervin, you have Wayhill Road, who kind of hasn't lived up to the sibling in the career. Took a while to break the maiden, but in the seventh race, the one horse. 9-2, I used that one underneath. I had what say the on top off the couple of wins down at Gulfstream. But Wayhill Road coming off the seasonal debut at Gulfstream, I'd expect a good performance from Shug. You know, as they say, at 9-2, offers a little bit of value. In horizontals, I would use both of those. I have the 12 and the 8 underneath. The 8 offering a little bit of a price pike place coming in from Fairgrounds, and I think that horse has the chance to be a little player as well.
This is a mile. This is an interesting race, too. A mile and an eighth. It's kind of a herky-jerky card. To be honest, a little kind of a mix and match group of races, and yeah, what say the that win at Gulfstream? Yeah, Karoom, 10-1
for the Catman.
For the Catman and obviously for Jerry Karoom, because it looks like he's a partner in this horse. The Flincher, 5-year-old, and broke the maiden two back at Fairgrounds, and then ran into some serious toughies in the allowance try. At 10-1, I want Karoom involved in this. Thanks.
I looked at him. I didn't wind up using him, but I wouldn't argue anybody off of him.
There you go. Well, especially a 10-1. And as you mentioned, yeah. Wayhill Road, of course, with that tremendous set of siblings, Gervin and Pirate's Punch, Grant Forster's hard hitter, and Midnight Bourbon, too. Wayhill Road's all brothers of Wayhill Road.
And I'll toss one more out, the finale today that they only have 8. But I thought at 6-1, I thought the firster from Doug O'Neill was interesting. You know, good magic on top and comes in with a workout that may signal some intent. And you look at the workouts, it's a Doug O'Neill horse, but going back to December, has been working in Kentucky. And so, you know, this seems like an interesting spot to debut, and 6-1 on the morning line. I'll take a little shot with the fresh face in there in the finale, number 6, Indy Magic.
Interesting. That mare. Petulante rings something of a. I don't know if it was her or if there was just another name Petulant, but Petulante. Take a glance here, actually, at this family too.
I used the 1, the 7, and the 5 underneath. The 1's the logical on the morning line, but the 7, by practical joke, I thought that horse in the third start may move forward. Same situation with Contemplation, Tyler Gaffleon on board for Stidham. The 5, also intriguing, at a little bit of a price maybe.
Yeah, well, that damn Malibu Moonmare, she was a 3-time winner, but of the minor variety, and this is her first foal. So not a lot to go on. A little bit of a turfy, something of a turfy family. Second Dam was a Dynaformer mare, and Tinsel. Huh. I thought this was a tricky read, this race. And I actually, I wasn't all that keen, on putting together. I printed it.
Oh, it's a tough card today.
Yeah, I printed it, and there were a couple of races. I said, you know what, I will wait tomorrow. I'm a little more interested in the late pick form. All right, how about run through your Tampa thoughts?
Tampa. Let me see if I have anything interesting. A couple weeks ago, I ran out of time, and the horse I was looking for wanted $20 that day. We were kind of right up against the clock. I'm like, don't win, don't. And then he wins at $20, and I didn't get a chance to toss it out. See if I have anything clever over at Tampa. The fourth race at 7-2, Firebird goes out for Gerald Bennett and Averill Racing, our Firebird. So obviously, you know, it's an Averill horse. But a little bit of class relief. I thought that horse might be a little bit interesting. I went six, nine, eight, and four. But again, we are the third choice with our Firebird. So it's hard to know, you know, it could float either way. But I thought even at the 7-2, this horse, this is not a strong field, but this is a horse that seems to be kind of moving in the right direction number wise. It's Gerald Bennett's fourth race. I'll take a little pop with the sixth horse in there.
Nice. The late action, actually, the late pick five, you're looking at 10 by 7 by 10 by 11 by 10. So, I mean, even with plenty of winter outfits, snowbirds having coming, you know, back to the east, you've got a nice group filling the entry box here.
Yeah, and in fact, the kickoff leg to the fifth race, I used our set, Ready Set Adios, the number 10 horse from Kathleen O'Connell, who obviously having a very, very good meet. Trying the turf, third career start, 8-1 on the morning line, outside post position. May have to work a little bit, but I think could, you know, kind of get a look at the rest of the field. So in that fifth, I would kick off maybe that sequence, certainly at least using the 10, Ready, Set, Adios.
Excellent. All right. Nice. 8-1 with the 5-pound bug.
And Adios Charlie is one of those sires that I find a little bit intriguing on the win early side of things. Hasn't gotten it done yet, but I always say if you get that win early breeding and they don't get it done, star one, star two, star three, and then there's a change up, take another look. And today the change up obviously is the surface.
Excellent. There you go. Seth Merrow, everybody, with some Tampa and with some Keeneland action.
And we'll be firing it up on TV probably in about an hour or so and take you through the afternoon.
Excellent. And you mentioned that, and I will tell people that, let's see, today's action, Horseshoe Indianapolis, Keeneland, Evangeline operates today as well. Parks with their card, Tampa, as noted, and Turf Paradise. There's your lineup for a Wednesday.
Yeah, should be a fun day. Kicking off another week, and looking forward to it. Welcome home.
Thank you.
Were you home for the and was it? It had to be. Were you? Were you home for the eclipse?
No, I was in California for the eclipse.
There was no eclipse.
There was no nothing. There was, you know, it was like a cloud passed by.
I find the science of it fascinating, but I wasn't like thrilled to look. So I went out and I was running in the park. But there was a lot of people in the park, you know, with the glasses. People offered me some glasses, so I took a look. But at one point, I ran by a small family, a mom, a dad, and maybe their kid was 10 years old, and they clearly wanted to go to total eclipse. They said they were headed to Lake Placid, and there was some kind of accident, I guess, on the north way. And so I'm sure they looked at their clock and said, we'll go to plan B. So they wind up at the park, and clearly the 10-year-old wanted total. I didn't realize this at first, but I walked by them. They're looking up with their glasses. I said, how is it? You know, is he good? This is right about the height of it. And the dad kind of goes, oh yeah, nice, nice, nice. And the kid, all hangdog, says, well, it's not total. And I said, well, I think it's pretty much total. I think it's 96%. The mom immediately jumps in and goes, 98. So clearly they had pushed this to the kid. And the kid then pauses and goes, 98.2 to be exact.
Oh, boy. Were these Asimovs that you ran into? What kind of family is this?
Wanted, and I will say, I did not realize that, but if we're 98.2, we were 1.8 off. And it was still light here. And my sister was up in Lake Class, and you saw it on TV. I guess total, if it went totally dark. And so I guess there was a significant difference that this kid missed out on, but I don't know.
Well, hopefully he's alive and whatever. When's the next?
He will clearly get another shot.
I didn't know anything about it until about 2 days before. I mean, I knew there. If it wasn't for Horseshoe Indianapolis, and we're going to talk to Rachel in about 15 minutes, I would not have even paid any attention to it. It was not on the radar.
I had talked to Nancy Holthus at Oaklawn a couple of weeks before, and they were right in the middle of it. And they were expecting like 500,000 people to come to Hot Springs.
Well, that's just to see Anthony Vellani and DeLuca's. That's just the line at DeLuca's, 500,000 people. Nice.
But we're happy to have you home.
Well,
glad you traveled safe.
You got me home for another, what's today, Wednesday? You got me home for 48 more hours, and then I'm gone.
Incredible.
Well, but
incredible.
But then you don't forget, you get boots on the ground reporting from Louisville for the viewers. So don't.
Oh, right. Yeah, very good.
Don't hesitate. All right?
Yeah, we'll check in. Definitely check in.
Got to go.
All right.
Seth Merrow, everybody. Seth Merrow 2 on your Twitter, number 1 in your heart. too funny. And thanks to Dave Grenning. Boy, thanks to everybody for correcting me. You people are the best. Let's see. Steve Carlin reporting that the 5 and the 7 have scratched at Keeneland. All right. So that changes things slightly at Keeneland in the nightcap. And Dave Grenning reporting that the turf was always scheduled in the book, as I having pulled up the book. So getting ready. And who else? Who else is hitting me with... and here's even Nick Hahn weighing in about those gray games, the machines and the backup bars. Yeah, that's an interesting topic. That was a big deal in Kentucky for a long time. So, all right, now everybody is. Thanks to everybody for pitching in. And Rachel is going to join us in about 15, which is perfect timing because we're going to spend these 15 with Tom Albertrani. I've been promising a Tom Albertrani visit and career celebration. Terrific career and one of our favorite people, one of the great families around the game. Tom Albertrani, congratulations on a wonderful career.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, you're among that, I guess, that group, that age that, just really feels, certain pressures and the way the game is, you to take advantage I applaud the decision.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I always, earlier in my younger days of training, I always had a goal maybe to, step out at the age of 65, 66. So I think it all worked out well. It was a great career. I mean, we just, I had a career that I could never imagine I ever would have. So it was really good.
Talk about, even your riding days. And, of course, if we're having this conversation, I'm obliged to put up the picture of you with Gary as the groom. That's one of the greatest pictures that Bob Coughlin's ever took. But talk about your life in the game, Tom, and reflect on on what it's given you, the people that made a difference for you.
Well, I started at 13 years old. My uncle Jack Abatamarga got me introduced into the game in. Just took me out on weekends and during summers, spring breaks, whatever, any opportunity I had, I was at the track working, started as a hot walker and, eventually, kind of worked my way up. And I always had a goal. I wanted to, ride races. I weighed 90 pounds in high school. And weight-wise wasn't an issue, but I was very tall, and I knew it wasn't going to be a long-lasting career. So I actually accelerated my high school senior year and got out a year earlier just so I could get my career started, because I knew, you know, I didn't have a lot of time. But and then I rode my first race. I think I was 19, 20, I think I was. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I wasn't great at it. I think size wise, you know, it hurt, but, I was never really, a good rider. I think later in my youth, my older days, I got better in time, you know, exercising horses, but, it was fun. I just had, you know, where can you be in the starting gate with Georgia Velasquez on one side and Angel Cadero on the other side? How much better does it get?
100%. I mean, that part of it, has got to be. I mean, who did you ride for mostly?
Mostly it was for the Settlechaks, Woody and Sue and Michael. They rode me quite a bit. And just to be on the New York circuit was such a, you know, a privilege, you know, to be riding in New York. I mean, I did a lot of riding out of state, but, you know, toward the end, as I got a little better, I was able to finish out in New York, and it was very exciting, very exciting.
And as that wound down, and I'm just looking, actually, I just thought to pull up, I don't know if I've ever done this, you rode your first winter in 1978. You had two good years in 79 and 80, with 300 and 200 mounts and 24 and 19 wins. Then in 81, you pretty much didn't, you know, you kind of only had 17 mounts the whole course of the year. And then in 82, you took your last calls, 44 starts with a couple of wins. And that was it.
Yeah. Well, you know, just to go back a little bit, when I first was starting to learn how to break horses, I went to Norman Cassie's farm in Ocala, and that's where I met Mark. Mark was 16 at the time, and he's still in high school. And we became really good friends. And once I lost my bug in New York, he told me, come down to Churchill. You know, he started to train horses at this time. And I went down there, and the first horse he put me on at Churchill was 99-1, and I won. So I thought my career might take another step forward, but it never did. So, you know, Mark said, you know, why don't you just, you know, you're getting a little heavier anyway. He said, why don't you just become an assistant trainer for me? And I said, well, you know, yeah, I mean, I know the ropes. Why not? So that's what I started doing. That's what I did for a while.
How about that? So your first job was on the training side was with Mark. Wow.
As an assistant trainer. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, and then of course, you know, they go take it from there. I mean, in terms of signing on with Bill Mott and, you know, the time involving, Darley and
one thing led to another. It was like just being in the right place at the right time. So I working for Mark as an assistant at Belmont Park, and, Bill had Cephas Beauty and Hitherton at the time. And he would ask if I could gallop them up into their races. And I said, sure, no problem. You know, I was available to help out. And that's how I got to know Bill. So eventually Mark left New York. I think he went to Kentucky maybe. And then Bill was coming in with the Firestone horses. And I had asked Bill, I'm looking for a job. Do you need any help? And as it worked out, he signed me on. And we were together for like 9 years or so. And that went really well until I got a call. Next thing I did, I got a call to go overseas and be with the Godolphin team. And we spent 6 months in Dubai and 6 months in England. I mean, how much better does that get?
No,
it does. Being around the best horses in the world. I mean, it was just an amazing, you know, thing to be able to do that. It's just hard to explain. I mean, just to be in those places was unbelievable.
How old were the girls at the time?
Teal would have been, I'd want to guess and say 7 or 8. And Noelle was born in Dubai after we were there for a couple of years. So they were able to spend, you know, some time and get to enjoy being overseas as well.
At what point did you make the call that, okay, it's time to, you know, hang a shingle and take on horses in your name?
Well, yeah, we were there for about 9 years, and I think I remember things were getting a little dicey there, you know, with the Iran wars breaking out and everything, and I just felt, you know, this might be a good time to go back home, maybe. So I was able to do that and, you know, gather up some support with Godolphin, and later on I was open to some outside horses, and just very lucky the horses that were coming into the barn, and just, you know, one thing led to another. It was amazing how many nice horses that went through the barn.
Wow. And, you know, it only took, two, 3 years, and Bernardini shows up.
Yeah, I mean, he really jump-started my career for sure, without a doubt. And then, you know, just one horse after another came through the barn, and we just had, you know, brilliant speed, Twilight Eclipse, Better Lucky, So Impressive, just to name a few, Styler's Joy. I mean, it's just, we just had a great barn of horses.
Well, and that, and what's interesting of you, the ones you name, the credit, you know, part of that credit and the credit to you, were the kind of clients you attracted. You talk about Mrs. Weber and you talk about Woods Lane West Point, and you know, it wasn't just Darley.
No, it was a great deal of support from a lot of people. You know, I'm really thankful for everyone that really had supported me. So, but you know, now things were just getting a little lighter, and I don't have the horsepower as we had, and I just thought this would be a good time to just take a little break and you know, see where we go.
Do you want to do something else? Do you want to do some bloodstock work or anything on that front, or is that not?
I don't know. You know, once you're in this game, you never really leave, you know?
So, yeah.
At the moment, I have one mare. It's a keeper. You probably
seen
her before.
Sure.
So I recently bred her, and I'll probably, you know, hopefully stay in the game with her, and hopefully sell some nice foals out of her, hopefully, in the future. But, you know, we'll just see where things go for now.
It got to, you know, you and I, essentially, you know, your career spans pretty much the exact time that I've been doing the show. And, you know, we've talked about so many of those horses. And I mean, obviously the Bernardini experience was special. And, you know, one of the, and I hate to even bring it, put it in this, you know, in this framework, Tom, you didn't even get a chance really to enjoy the Preakness win properly under those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you really hate to see that happen. I did enjoy it somewhat, but you're still thinking about, you know, Barbara and what happened. It's on your mind more, and it's a little bittersweet for sure. So, you know, once we got through the Preakness, I remember Bernardini was winning the Travers, and I was just thinking to myself, now I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah, exactly, right? And the Gold Cup as well.
Yeah, right.
You know, he went on a tremendous tear, and you know, if you predate, you know, it wasn't like Bernardini was the first. In fact, your first stake win, your first graded stake win, was a Grade One itself. The gorgeous Boletto.
That's true. That's exactly right.
She was fabulous. You had a horse that we adored. Was Songster.
Songster was such a personality.
Oh my God.
We loved that horse. I had given him away to one of my owners who said he would home him for the rest of his life, and he was in Ocala. So Teal just loved the horse. So she would always tell me, Dad, you got to get Songster back. Make him your pony. And I'm thinking, well, if I remember right, he was a bit of a strong-headed horse. I don't know if he would really want to be a pony or not. But anyway, we tracked him down. He went to Ocala, and I made him a home right in the barn, and he was just like the barn pet. So we took him out, we ride him a little bit, kept him happy, and he was a really nice horse to have around.
I saw him a lot, and when we got to spend time around the barn, he was particularly fun. You know, certain horses that you remember from that, from that ilk. You mentioned Brilliant Speed, a bluegrass win. You've got one of those resumes that is top heavy with grade ones, right? You're the Chris Carter of trainers. You won more grade ones than you did grade twos or threes.
I didn't count every one of them.
Well, I can go to the stake side of things. Saddler's Joy with the Sword Dancer, Twilight Eclipse, the Man of War. Better Lucky, forgotten about, First Lady win. Zo Impressive, who we cashed. Lee Einsiedler still thanks me for the push on Zo Impressive, who won the Mother Goose. Better Lucky won the Matriarch. We mentioned Brilliant Speed winning the Bluegrass. The Oaks with the American Oaks with Gossip Girl, right? Gossip Girl. The ill-fated Odysseus. I just seeing his name.
That was one of my favorite races, watching that horse win the Tampa Bay Derby. If you recall the race, and I can't recall the track announcer's name off the top of my head.
Richard Grunder.
Yes, and during the running of the race, he was up closer to the pace, and then he started dropping back at about the 5.16 pole, and He called Odysseus, "We'll have to wait another day," because he was dropping back out of the race. And then at the April, here he comes in between horses, and I didn't think he even won. I said, he got beat a dirty nose. And then they put our number up, and it was like, oh my gosh, that was just unbelievable race.
Well, and for Satish and Ann and everybody, on hand to win at his home track, awfully special.
Yeah, it was. It was very exciting.
Unfortunately, he would get hurt right after was the bluegrass he came out wrong?
Yes, it was a poly track that year, and we tried him on it, but after the race, he had some slight injury, and that kind of stopped his career.
Well, and for those that don't remember that Tampa Bay Derby, the Kentucky Derby winner was third, Super Saver, who you beat that day. So that one I recall fondly. But do you have a moment, Tom, that stays with you more than any other?
Well, naturally, it would be the Preakness, to be part of the Triple Crown. Very, very exciting, although, we saw Barbaro get injured. But and everyone was just as exciting as the other. I don't think it mattered if it was a 25 claimer, but you still get the same thrill. You know what I mean? But naturally, the bigger races, you like to win more, but Everyone's exciting. Everyone. And I'm going to miss that probably more than anything.
Well, we'll miss the opportunity to call and congratulate you, but couldn't let this go by without the opportunity to talk. And I think I got to do this tomorrow with Ralph Nix. It's kind of crazy, right? That you and Ralph basically retire at the same time.
We work together at the same time as well for Bill Mott.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I did speak with Ralph about a week ago, and I'm very excited for him as well. Sounds like he has a plan. So we all wish him well too.
Well, you got the two wonderful girls that everybody knows from the racetrack and who worked on the track, and as sweet and kind and respectful and. I mean, that everybody adores. Tom, thanks for everything and continued success at whatever, because that's all you've ever had is success.
Well, I appreciate it, Steve. Thanks so much.
Tom Albertrani, and just a wonderful person, a wonderful family, a terrific career, capable with all kinds, turf sprinters, dirt sprinters like Songster, classic horses, Bernardini, and lasting legacy, and a lot of stallions involved in there. None bigger, of course, than Bernardini. Let's get a final few minutes, 7, 8, 9 minutes to close out this Wednesday. The first conversation of the Horseshoe Indianapolis season with Rachel, and she ended up never visiting me in Vegas. I mean, you visited, but you never grabbed the microphone, which is not like you.
I know. Whenever I came over, you were always talking to somebody so interesting, and then by the time I came back, by the time you were done, then I was off doing some other interview. You and I were interviewing everyone all day.
Well, you had another fabulous experience, and in fact, I told Eric last week that your performance there again this year was just spectacular, and you were out in front of every important story and every player that was making a move. So well done, and the Caesars team clearly love having you on hand.
Yeah, thank you so much. That is so much work but so much fun, and I got to give a shout out to the team that I worked with last year. Was the same one. It was GD Hieronymus, and some people in the horse racing industry probably know who he is, but he has been my most favorite producer to work with, because here at Indiana, I'm like the producer. I, do the production schedule and say what we're going to do and who we're going to interview and all that. So it's very nice to have someone like GD, who has done this forever, to help me find stories and stuff. So he kind of turned me loose a little bit this year. Last year, he kind of guided me around, but this year he kind of turned me loose and let me do my thing. So him and Nyssa and they're just, the whole team was really great. So I had a blast. And obviously the NHC ladies, Michelle and everybody, they're awesome. So thanks so much.
Well, and GD, of course, I worked with him for the Final Table telecast, which we did, which was riotously fun and was over. I mean, it was a complete blur, to be honest. It doesn't matter if you turn the cameras on or you turn the mics on, but it just, the action drives, the whatever show you're doing.
GD, we had,
it was just a seamless, in terms of production. He's the industry's go-to. There's nobody better, industry wide. I didn't really get into any handicapping for the opening ceremony, as it were. And there was a nice celestial tie-in. That was very clever of Tammy and the team to utilize the eclipse as opening day.
Yeah, Tammy mentioned that the year before, like a year out from the eclipse, she had seen that it was going to be here. And in one of our planning meetings, she said, hey, maybe next year we could do, a race or whatever on that day. And man, after all of the hype and everyone talking about how, what a big deal it was going to be, we were a little nervous. We were like, man, we shouldn't have done this. This is kind of insane. But wow, what a great day it ended up being. And both Eric and I kind of had the same attitude, like, oh, we shouldn't have done this. This is going to be insane. And then after the eclipse, we both looked at each other and I was like, that was freaking awesome. He was like, yeah, this was great. So there was a great crowd and we had live music and it was awesome.
I did not get a chance to watch because I was leaving. I was traveling, but from California. But if you just talk about the atmosphere and you took the almost two hour break, after the thoroughbred card and then the couple of quarter horse races, but the band on hand, the local band, it pretty much met all the expectations. And how big of a crowd did you have?
Yeah, I can't remember if you were here when we had the new awning. We didn't want to build grandstand, so we have this giant awning that's on the front of the building now. And me, Tammy, and Eric, and shout out to Eric's wife, Chris. She's like the mastermind behind some of this organizing. But we kind of organized it to where when you walk out of the OTB, the betting area, there's a little stage there where I can do interviews if it's raining, or we can have a band. And then the bar area is in the middle. And then we have some nice patio furniture from the Family Leisure, the company that I do the commercial before, and that everyone loved it. That we set that thing up. Chris and I were out painting chairs like the day before to make sure it looked really nice. And there was like a one or two man band that would play under the awning throughout the races. And then during the eclipse, we had a very popular band here in Indiana play in the summer band, and they're amazing. And they did, so there were tons of people there. The crowd was amazing. All the horsemen said this was the best opening day we've ever had.
Nice.
And when the eclipse, so they started to play a song when we finished that last thoroughbred race. And then once the eclipse, it started getting darker, they were like playing the Star Wars Darth Vader march music, which just added to it. Like they weren't singing. They were just playing, you know, that, and that being in the background when it got dark was just, it was so cool. And then literally everyone just came together and stood out on the apron in front of the winner's circle all throughout the apron. And we all just stood there and stared and marveled, and it was great. And we had really, really a great handle. And Eric did kind of a shorter card, but he was like, man, I wish I would have done, you know, a couple more races, because everybody was, you know, betting on us, and it was a really fun day.
Wow. Well, congratulations. And now the heavy lifting starts, I guess. You know, the season starts to really pull out now, and we got only about two, three minutes. I mean, we'll do more thorough handicapping in coming weeks and months, but how about a couple of opinions, maybe something in this late pick four?
Yeah, you know, when I was doing the schedule yesterday, I was like, gosh, all these maidens. I did want to say a lot of people have been asking me and sending me messages on Twitter and X, and a lot of friends have been texting me asking me why all the races are the same distance. But honestly, you know, the Indiana breds, a lot of them have been off for,
right,
you know, quite a while. So if people remember, we don't normally have very many long races at the beginning of the year anyways, because these horses are just, you know, they're trying to build the stamina back up. So he's just been keeping it at the short distance, but it's not for any particular reason. I just wanted to say that in public, because I have a lot of questions, so people if they're wondering. So there's a lot of maidens today, and then in race five we have the early pick four and then the late pick four, which starts in race five, and it's got a couple of maiden special weights, and then a really nice allowance, and also a starter optional claimer that I am still scratching my head about, to be completely honest with you. I haven't put together an official ticket, but just looking at the fifth race, where we have these maidens, these are, you know, open, but state breds get the extra money here. You know, the horse that's trying dirt would be a little bit of a long shot for me that's coming from Turfway. The three I'll probably include with probably the favorite. This one hasn't ever tried dirt, but looks like is in form as of the last couple of races, which, you know, we're not seeing a lot of that right now. I noticed yesterday that the horses that have ran, that people were betting, the odds were lower on some of those horses than I thought they should have been. And people were really betting on the horses that did have, you know, recent races, which makes sense, but I definitely could tell. So keep that in mind when you're betting. But this is a jump up, but I thought this would be a nice one just to see. You never know what they're going to do when they run, you know, on a surface for the first time. And we saw some long shots yesterday. Alimony, this $250,000 filly here, is obviously going to get a lot of, you know, action today, probably. Uncle Mo filly, she's got nice work. Steve Smithson, you know, the first year he was here 3 years ago, people would bet on him, and his horses, they weren't doing that great here the first year. Last year, I don't know if he finally figured Indiana out. I mean, he is, like, you know, it's Steve Asmussen, so of course he did, but they did really well last year. And I had a couple of nice long shots that he had placed in some nice spots. So I always look at him when he's got horses here in Indiana. And then I think probably this horse on the outside, you know, the 9 and 10 are interesting, but I think I'll keep it to probably that first time starter. Moon Fleet is going to get, you know, some class relief. And then maybe the one I mentioned, the little bit of long shot, the three that's trying dirt for the first time, probably what I would go with in
there
here.
There you go. So a little 3, 4, and 9. I will throw in Tommy Drury with the upstart filly, who's getting first Lasix, last seen Churchill in September. She's got some speed. End of Innocence, the 7, 5 to 1, Cherry Valley Farm. This is a Brary Jones bred out of a Blame mare. So I'm going to use some 7. Rach, great to connect. Get the season started. I appreciate it. We'll be talking regularly.
Hey, it was good to talk to you, Steve. Talk to you guys later.
Rachel McLaughlin, everybody, and the action from Horseshoe Indianapolis. 5.5 furlong is that yeah, they're, so you can understand that, you know, these horses have been off for the winter. Thanks to Rach. Thanks to Tom Albertrand. Wanted to get that conversation. And Seth Merrow, Joe Skirto, the horseman in Minnesota. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus with Fernando, brought to you by Hill and Dale. And earlier, Dick Powell, of course, HKJC action that kicked us off, right? And Jessica Martinez, OBS, which is 90 minutes in already. Good luck on your playing today, everybody. Gave you some ideas for Keeneland and for Indy. And Thursday at the race is tomorrow, 9 o'clock. If you miss anything, archive podcast, etc., post-production. Replay, 6 to 9. Here on Sirius. Talk to you in the morning.
Horsemen, nominate now for Penn National's biggest day of the season, the $400,000 Grade 3 Penn Mile. In the $150,000 Penn Oaks will both be run Friday, May 31st, on a card that also includes 2 Pennsylvania bred stakes, each with a $100,000 purse. Call the racing office at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse, 800-233-8238. That's 800-233-8238. Nominations close May 15th.
Racing 2-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.